Well, this is Fight the Empire, and that was our previous theme music. But anyway, it's always nice to hear Thelonious Monk. And our guest is Professor Juan Cole, who's a professor of history at the University of Michigan and an authority on the Middle East. And he's the author of a book, Engaging the Muslim World, which is being coming out in a paperback edition, or it has come out in a paperback edition. And so, Professor Cole, are you there?
I am.
Well, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much.
Well, I thought we'd start out talking about the book and then maybe later on get into what's going on right now. You know, this book is sort of an antidote to Islam anxiety, as you call it. So tell us about it.
Well, the argument is that for a long time, and especially since September 11th, the United States has viewed the Muslim world through a lens that highlights a problem of terrorism, which certainly does exist, but that this lens has been used for all kinds of other purposes, and indeed, I think, has been quite unhelpful in dealing with the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, and dealing with Iran, and dealing with Saddam Hussein's Iraq. So just to give an example, the allegation against Saddam Hussein that he was actively training al-Qaeda operatives in the use of chemical weapons, which was part of Colin Powell's speech to the UN, was repeated by then-Vice President Dick Cheney, and so forth, was complete nonsense and has been disproven definitively by the documents captured by the U.S. from the Iraqi bureaucracy after the war. So it's an argument that this anxiety about Islam is misplaced. It's also an argument that the United States is going to be having a lot to do with the Muslim world in the Middle East, for all kinds of reasons that have nothing to do with culture. The Middle East has two-thirds of the world's proven petroleum reserves. It has about half of the world's proven gas reserves. If you add those into Muslim Central Asia, it really is quite a lot of the world's energy coming from that region. And then the Muslim world is undergoing a population boom at a time when populations are declining elsewhere. By 2050, it's estimated we'll have about 9 billion people in the world, if we're lucky, if it's not more. And nearly a third of those may well be Muslim. So the United States can't go through the next centuries like an ostrich hiding from the Muslim reality.
Well, you know, part of the problem is, you know, it's like a lot of people seem to think that history began, in 2001. It's like coming in the middle of a bad movie and you see one guy hit another and you think, oh, well, you know, but if you come in the beginning of the movie, maybe you see that the victim hit the other guy. I mean, it's just, the real history, the history of what's going on now, I think, really began right after World War One.
In many ways, certainly the modern Middle East was created by World War One and the aftermath, the Versailles settlement, the ways in which the victors, the British and the French in particular, but also the Italians, carved up what had been the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East and made a series of colonies, which then evolved into dependent nation states. That's been a lot of it. Certainly it was that process that created the Palestine-Israel problem. And it brought into being, as a reaction against the plan, a highly secular military regime in Turkey, which separated Turkey from the rest of the Middle East. And in many ways, it's only now in the opening decades of the 21st century that the World War One settlement is beginning to become undone.
And, they put a few kings on thrones, some of whom were overthrown. It's interesting you mentioned the overthrow of the king in Iraq by General Qasim.
That's right. So the British invaded what is now Iraq during World War One, because the Ottoman Empire, which was the big Muslim-ruled empire based in what is now Turkey, controlled much of what we now call the Middle East and the Arab world as well, and they ruled Iraq. And the British sent troops up from British India and took Iraq during World War One. And the Iraqis were hoping to emerge then as an independent state after the war. But the British had other ideas. They decided to try to keep Iraq for themselves as a what was called a mandate from the League of Nations, but it was really just a colony. And it was because Iraq was very useful to the British Empire, as you know, it was the route through which you could get airmail to British India. And Basra was an important port for British India. So the British kept Iraq, and as you say, they installed over it a monarchy, which had nothing to do with Iraq. They brought in somebody from Mecca, Faisal bin Hussein, who had been useful to the British in their fight against the Ottomans, and created a dynasty. They also created a system in Iraq which favored an aristocracy of very large landowners, and they created all kinds of inequalities in that society that were new and disturbing to people. So by 1958, it was a highly unequal society, a few big landowning families on most of the land.
Okay, here we are, Fight the Empire with Professor Juan Cole. You know, a friend of mine from Iraq says that General Qasim was the best ruler that Iraq ever had.
Well, Qasim had virtues and was very popular in Iraq. Mm-hmm. He undertook land reform. And some historians think that, you know, you might have had a communist revolution among the desperately poor peasants of Iraq had he not intervened to break up those huge estates and create a rural middle class. The urban sector did well under his rule. He got more control. So, holdings, and unfortunately for him, he was overthrown in a fascist coup, the Ba'ath Party being a kind of covert revolutionary party that combined socialism and Arab nationalism and organized among the officers, and he was overthrown and killed in 1963.
Well, I read that actually in 59, the CIA hired a young Saddam Hussein to assassinate him.
Well, Saddam Hussein was a member of the Ba'ath Party in his youth, and he did attempt to assassinate Qasim. I can't, as a historian, nail down proof that the CIA put him up to it, but it's certainly the case that Saddam tried to kill the man. Saddam was not a very good assassin. He stationed people on either side of Qasim's car to shoot at it as it went by, and they shot each other.
Including him, too, I think.
Yeah, he was wounded by his own men.
Wow.
It's not the right way to do an assassination. And then they missed the president.
Well, let's talk about, you have an interesting section in the book, Engaging the Muslim World, on the Muslim Brotherhood, which seems to be, everybody's talking, will the Muslim Brotherhood take over in Egypt, you know, and what will this mean? And make it sound very, very sinister.
Right. So the accusation, well, first of all, the Muslim Brotherhood is a social movement that functions a little bit like a political party, but it's not recognized in Egypt as a political party. It was founded in 1928, and it reminds me a little bit, you know, in its founding of Campus Crusade for Christ. You know, it was an attempt to get the young people to be pious, to turn to Islam, to practice Islam, and they would get together for picnics and gatherings, and it became wildly popular. It had a strong anti-imperialist bent. The Muslim Brotherhood really minded that Egypt had been colonized by the British in 1882, and that the British were still very powerful in Egypt all through the 20th century until 1956. So the Brotherhood agitated against British influence and against the legacy of British administration and law. They were also strongly pro-Palestinian and were very disturbed by the British plan to turn Palestine into a national homeland for the Jews. and displaced the Palestinians. So they held demonstrations in Cairo in favor of the Palestinians. And in the 40s, they actually turned to violence. They developed a terrorist wing, and that was discovered, and the movement was suppressed and crushed. And all through the 50s and 60s, a lot of the Brotherhood was underground or in jail. But then in the 1970s, Anwar al-Sadat let them out on grounds that they promised to stop being violent, which they did. And they started running for parliament, and they became kind of a junior partner in the Egyptian system, although they were also a kind of opposition to it.
So where are they now? Do you think they, you know, are they waiting in the wings? Who's going to take over? Where is Egypt going now? Well, it looks like Mubarak is on his way out, kicking and screaming and flailing around, and El-Baradei is sort of regarded as not a very likely successor, and there's this guy that's just named vice president who is the intelligence man and one of the torturers. Where is that country going?
Right. So since 1952, Egypt has been a military dictatorship, and it still is today. The popular protests against that military dictatorship in the last couple of years have been mounted by labor activists, youth activists, and the Muslim Brotherhood has been a minor part of that. In fact, the big labor demonstrations that were mounted 2 years ago were not supported by the Muslim Brotherhood, and people were angry at it for its lack of support. In a way, both the Egyptian left and the Egyptian right are among civilian politicians are done out with military rule. And so for now, they have an uneasy alliance of convenience. The Brotherhood is supporting the current uprising, but it's not central to it. It's not leading it. And the government is trying to peel the Brotherhood off. So Omar Suleiman, the new vice president, offered to talk to the Muslim Brotherhood leaders today. And I think he's hoping that he could maybe offer them a cabinet post or find some way to mollify them and split them from the more leftist labor and youth activists. And the Brotherhood refused. So far, that tactic's not working.
Hmm. Well, the you think that, you know, the Obama is being criticized for being kind of, I don't know, soft on the Muslim Brotherhood. You think the Obama administration is moving in the right direction?
Well, what the Obama administration said was that it was thinking of reaching out to have some kind of contact with the party. The United States, mostly, in most countries, has all kinds of contacts with all kinds of parties. And there's been a kind of informal ban on talking to the Muslim Brotherhood for reasons that are not entirely clear. It certainly is a player in Egyptian politics. It has a large number of seats in parliament. In the last parliament, it had 88 seats out of 454. So why the U.S. shouldn't talk to it, I can't understand myself. The Brotherhood is pro-Palestinian, but then almost everybody in the Arab world is pro-Palestinian. If that's a reason not to talk to people, then we can't talk to Arabs. So I think it's right for the United States to multiply its contacts among the Egyptian political parties, and I think it's crazy to criticize Obama for that. I mean, I think if the Obama administration can be criticized for anything, it's for soft-peddling Mubarak's dictatorship. Hillary Clinton said initially she was sure the Egyptian regime was stable. Then Vice President Joe Biden said that Hosni Mubarak is not a dictator. And we saw his lack of dictatorship yesterday when 1,000 people were wounded in a brutal crackdown, done certainly by secret police in plain clothes at the order of the Egyptian government, which is now, you know, coming out and apologizing for what happened. I mean, how stupid do they think we are?
Well, maybe they think we're more stupid than the people who actually live there. But now, let me plug this book. This is an amazing book, Engaging the Muslim World. It's really, it's very helpful in understanding what is going on. you know, around the in the Middle East. I mean, it includes chapters on Egypt and Iraq and Iran and Israel, Palestine, Saudi Arabia. It's really it sort of covers everything. It sort of gives you a good background, a good foundation for understanding what is going on. People are making a connection between Egypt today and Iran in 1979. And Professor Cole, do you think that's a good connection or is that spurious?
Well, I have a blog post at my Informed Comment blog sort of on the reasons for which Iran 1978-79 is not like Egypt today. And, you know, first of all, Egypt is a Sunni Muslim country, doesn't have ayatollahs, and there's not a tradition in Egypt of being ruled by religious leaders. Egyptians are fairly religious people, but for the most part, in their modern history, they have preferred relatively secular political parties. And the movement we're seeing today is, above all, a labor movement. It is young people sympathetic with the plight of factory workers and urban marginal workers in the Egyptian system. So it doesn't look very much like Ayatollah Khomeini's Iranian revolution.
Well, you have in your blog, you have an interesting article on Mubarak's Basij. Now, the Basij are these sort of thugs that were roaming around in Tehran, hitting on people. And we saw that the other day in Liberation Square in Cairo.
That's right. Well, I think that Mubarak is taking a page from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and trying to suppress the popular uprisings by raising the cost of protesting, by simply breaking heads, attacking people, shooting them in some instances, but certainly beating them with sticks. And yesterday they were attacked on horseback and so forth. And the Iranian regime used people on motorcycles. The Egyptian regime wanted to make it look as though this was a spontaneous action by civilians. And actually, these are almost certainly paid enforcers and secret police of the Egyptian government. So they couldn't dress them up in uniforms and put them on motorcycles, but they did send them in to beat people up and injure them and just make the point that if you're going to come out to protest, you have to expect your head to be broken, in hopes that fewer people will come out to protest under those circumstances. And that technique was very successful in tamping down the protests in Iran.
Mm. Well, I think we're getting near the end of our program. We've been talking to Professor Juan Cole, who's the author of Engaging the Muslim World, and he has a blog. It's called Informed Comment, which is really worth checking out. It's something you could check every day because there's really interesting stuff on it. I'd like to thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And do you have any more books coming out soon? Or
Not immediately, but that one really treats our current crisis.
I think so. It really gives people a foundation for understanding the Middle East. So thank you again for being with us, Professor Juan Cole.
It's my pleasure.
And stay tuned for Air Cascadia. Stay tuned. There's always something good on KBOO. And give the membership people a call.